his own. Martha looked at Spencer and saw he was appalled and despised him for it. Perhaps he imagined they ought to be decently miserable in their lot and not snatch pleasure wherever they saw it.
"Take partners," bellowed the soldier. "Try this one for size."
And it wasn't a military melody he played then, but with something in it of sailors on deck sighting land. Martha held out her hands to a passing lad who'd discarded his kitten on a doorstep, and with great strength in his thin forearms flung her round so that Spencer saw all her hair fan out, wheat-coloured against the grimy brickwork.
"Heave me away, my bully bully boys," sang the girl in white. "I'm bound for South Australia."
And as she passed, Charles, she dipped her head as though accepting a compliment he hadn't thought to give. A little distance away, unseen in an alley, Edward Burton's enemy was watching. Addled with beer and loathing, Samuel Hall woke each morning with hatred sharpening in his belly as keenly as any knife. Daily vigils outside Burton's home had given glimpses of the enemy himself, and of frequent visitors so obviously wealthy it was as if Burton had entered the wards of the royal borough a pauper and left them a king. What could they know of his cruelty? Of how he'd soured Hall's sole hope of happiness? Worse, there'd been mention in The Standard of the operation that had cheated Hall of justice. Two columns and a photograph in praise of a surgeon who looked like nothing so much as a glowering demon. His hatred for Burton doubled and spent itself on this other man. What right did he have to meddle in the ways of God? The knife went in, it had struck the heart. That ought to have been the end of it, and he might have had peace. And here he was, that same man, black-browed, a little hunched, and with him three companions, a woman he recognised for her thick hair braided at the crown, and two men he did not. Hall had watched them greeted at Burton's door and seen them framed in Burton's window. They'd passed plates of food between them, while Hall himself could not bear to eat. They'd laughed when he'd forgotten anything but misery. He'd followed them all the way and seen them dancing when he himself had lost all joy. Hall put his hand in his pocket and pricked his thumb on the blade hidden there. If Edward Burton were to remain always just beyond his reach, here, at least, might be a chance at retribution. The soldier paused, his arm was tired. In the silence, the dancers grew suddenly ashamed. The tenements and gutters seemed all at once more sordid and more bleak. Luke took his arm from the girl's waist and bowed, as if with apology. "They brush their hair with codfish bones," she sang to the soldier invitingly. But he was tired and wouldn't play more. Charles glanced at his watch. It had been a charming display in its way, though perhaps a detail to be omitted from his report to the department. But he wanted his dinner, and before he could reach that happy conclusion to the day, he'd need to bathe for an hour at least.
"And possibly,"
he thought, only a little ashamed of himself,
"burn my clothes." "Spencer, Martha, have we seen enough? Have we done our duty?" "Oh, but look here, who's this? Dr. Garrett, he seems to want you. Is this a friend of yours?"
He gestured away to his right, and at first Luke saw nothing beside the children dispersing and the soldier counting out the coppers in his cap. Then the child in the fairy wings yelped and swore. She'd been pushed aside in a sudden jostling and tumbled wailing onto the stones.
"What's going on?" said Charles, drawing his coat closer.
Was it pickpockets? Catherine had warned him to take care.
Spencer, can you see what's going on?
The group of children parted. A kitten broke loose and yowled from a windowsill. And Charles saw a short man in a brown coat come at them with his head held low and one hand thrust in his pocket. Thinking the man was in distress, Martha stepped forward and held out her hands.
"What is it?" she said. "What's happened? Can we help?"
Samuel Hall did not reply, only went on running, and they saw it was Luke he wanted. He reached the surgeon, who at first was a little amused, fended the man off with a jovial shove.
"Do I know you? Have we met?"
Hall began to mutter beneath breath, sour with beer, all the while putting his hand in his pocket and drawing it out again, as if he couldn't decide what to do next.
"You shouldn't have gone and interfered with my business. It wasn't fair. I'll show you what's coming to him."
Luke grew troubled then, but for all his strength could not push the man away. He found himself pressed against the wall, scrabbling at the brick. He cast about for help and found it. For there was Spencer, who with his hands on the man's shoulder wrenched him away from his friend. Then the man fell to a kind of drunken sobbing that was also a little like laughter. Raising his eyes upward, he said,
"Again? Will you believe it? Cheated again of all I'm due."
"Poor chap's quite mad," said Charles,
watching the man in the gutter. Then he saw him put his hand in his pocket and take out a blade.
"Watch out,"
he said, coming forward, feeling each hair lift on the nape of his neck.
"Watch out! He has a knife! Spencer, stay back!"
But Spencer had turned away from the fallen man and was slow with the shock of the fight. He looked dumbly at Charles and at his friend.
"Luke," he said, "are you hurt?"
"Winded," said Luke, "that's all."
Then he saw Hall scrabble to his feet, and how light gleamed on the blade. Saw how he raised his arm and lunged at his friend with an animal's cry. In the long moment that followed, he saw also Spencer laid out upon a mortuary table, his fine fair hair falling back against the wood, and it was unbearable. He'd never felt so appalling a surge of terror. Luke hurled himself forward with hands outstretched. He reached the man, he reached the knife. They tumbled to the pavement. Samuel Hall fell first and fell heavily. His head struck a curbstone with a sound like that of a nut being cracked. The soldier had moved on to other alleys, and they heard the organ playing something like a lullaby, so that the watching children thought perhaps the black-haired man who danced with them was sleeping, since he lay so still. But Luke had neither passed out nor been knocked unconscious. He lay there unmoving because he knew what had been done to him, and he couldn't bear to look.
"Luke, can you hear us?" said Martha, touching him with gentle hands.
He roused, then sat up and turned towards them, and the colour left Martha's cheek. From collar to belt his shirt was scarlet, and his right hand and forearm were gloved with blood. When Charles came close, having seen that the brown-coated man would certainly never get up again, he thought at first the doctor was clutching a scrap of meat. But it was the flesh of his own hand, flayed from the bone where the knife had crossed his palm as he grasped it, so that it hung down towards the wrist in a thick and glistening flap. Underneath it greyish bones were visible, and a tendon or ligament of some kind had been severed and lay in among the blood like pale ribbon snipped with scissors. Luke appeared not to be in pain, only grasped his right wrist with his left hand, peering at the visible bones of his hand and reciting, over and over, as if it were a liturgy.
"Scaphoid. Unciform. Carpus. Metacarpus.
Then his black eyes rolled backward, and he fell into the arms of his kneeling friends.
Chapter 2.
A mile or so west of that dim courtyard, Cora came up towards St. Paul's with a letter in her pocket. Her time in London had been dreary. Friends came and went and found her standoffish and distrait. Cora, for her part, found them all too neatly turned out and too cautiously spoken. The women's hands were white, their nails sharp and glossy. The men were shaved pink as children or wore absurd moustaches. They knew their politics and their scandal and which restaurants would serve you the latest fad, but Cora would have liked to sweep everything off the table and say, "Yes, yes, but have I told you how once I stood by an iron grating in Clerkenwell and heard the buried river running out to meet the Thames? Did you know I laughed the day my husband died? Have you ever seen me kiss my son? Do you never talk, ever, about anything that matters?" Catherine Ambrose had visited with Joanna by her side. Soon after Stella's diagnosis, Catherine and Charles Ambrose had taken charge of the Ransom children. Dr. Butler, awaiting Will's decision on how his wife should be treated, urged peace and good clean air, and the children sent elsewhere. Appalled to find his quiet home full and noisy, Charles nonetheless found himself coming home earlier than necessary, and with his pockets stuffed full of Cadburys and games of cards, which he played with them until rather too late in the evening. They all longed for Stella, but bore it bravely. Joanna was at once let loose on the Ambrose library, but also learned to curl her hair with rags. James drew devices of impossible complexity and sent them to his mother in envelopes sealed with wax.
"I am glad to see you," said Cora truthfully.
Joanna had grown almost into womanhood in the space of a month and wore her mother's eyes above her father's mouth. She was studying hard at Charles's books and intended, she said, to be a doctor or a nurse or an engineer, something like that. She hadn't decided. Then she'd remember her mother and how much she missed her, and her violet eyes would grow cloudy.
"What are you doing here in London, Cora?" said Catherine,
nibbling at a square of bread and butter.
"What made you leave when you were so happy and saw so much? If ever anyone could unravel the mystery of the Black Water Beast, it surely should be you. At Midsummer, we all said you looked a country girl born and bred, and doubted we'd ever see you get on a train again."
"Oh, all that mud and muddle," said Cora brightly, not fooling her friend for an instant. "I'm a city mouse, and always was. All those mad girls, that whispering about the serpent, the horse shoes in the oak tree. I thought if I stayed any longer I'd go mad. Besides," she listlessly crumbled a piece of bread, "I didn't really know what I was doing. But you're going back to Essex soon, though, aren't you?" said Joanna. "You shouldn't leave your friends when they're ill, because that's when they need you." Her tears came and could not be stopped.
"Oh, yes,"
said Cora, ashamed of herself.
"Jojo, of course I'm going back."
Later, Catherine said, "What did happen, Cora?"
"Will Ransom, you talked about him so much. I was almost afraid of what was coming. But then I saw him with you, and you barely spoke, and I thought you hardly liked each other. It seemed a strange friendship, but then you never did do anything the way the rest of us might. And now, with Stella as she is..."
But Cora who since her widowhood could never conceal a thought that passed behind her eyes, drew down the blinds and tersely said, "There was nothing strange about it. We enjoyed each other's company for a time. That is all." If Cora could have explained what had gone awry, she might have done. But all the thought that she gave it, late into the night and immediately on waking, she could not unravel things. She'd prized Will's affection because it was impossible that he might want her as Michael once had. His affection was bounded off on all sides by Stella and his faith, and by what she'd gratefully thought was his complete failure to notice she was a woman. "I might as well be a head in a jar of formaldehyde, for all he cares," she'd once said to Martha. "It's why he prefers to write to me than see me. I'm only a mind, not a body. I'm safe as a child. Don't you see how I might prefer it?" And she believed it, too. Even now, when she thought of that moment when everything had shifted, she saw the fault as hers, not his. She ought not to have looked at him the way she did, and she had no idea why she'd done it. Something in the hard flexing of his fingers against her flesh had struck something off in her, and he had seen it, and it had thrown him off balance. Certainly his letters now were kind enough, but it seemed to her a kind of innocence was lost. Then Luke's letter had come, and it was she who was thrown off balance. It was not that she'd been oblivious to his love, since he cheerfully declared it so often, but that it was no longer possible to laugh and declare that she, too, loved her imp. A kind of innocence was lost. Worse, it seemed an attempt to force her hand. All the years of what ought to have been her youth, she'd been in someone's possession. And now, with hardly a few months' freedom to her name, someone wanted to put their mark on her again. "I know you cannot return, my love," he'd said. But no one ever wrote such a letter without hope. Crossing the Strand up by St. Paul's, she found a letterbox and tossed in a letter addressed to Dr. Garrett with a kind of contempt. From somewhere behind her, there came the sound of music, and she saw on the cathedral steps a man in a torn soldier's tunic turning the handle of a barrel organ. His left sleeve was empty, and the sun picked out the medal on his breast. The melody was a merry one, and it lifted her mood. She crossed to where he sat and dropped a few coins in his cap. Cora Seaborne, care of Midland Grand Hotel, London, the 20th of August. "Luke, your letter came. How could you? How could you? Do you think I should pity you? I don't. You pity yourself enough for the two of us. You say you love me. Well, I knew that. And I love you. How could I not? And you call it crumbs? Friendship is not crumbs. You're not grubbing around for scraps while someone else takes a whole loaf. It's all I've got to give. All right, once I might have had more, but for now, it's all I've got. Well, let's leave it there. Cora." Cora Seaborne, care of the Midland Grand Hotel, London, the 21st of August. "Luke, my imp, my dear, what have I done? I wrote without knowing what had happened. Martha told me what you did, and I am not surprised. You have always been the bravest man I know. And I tried to lecture you on friendship when I have never done for anyone what you have done for him. Tell me when I can come. Tell me where you are. With my love, dear Luke, believe me, Cora." George Spencer, M.D., Pentonville Road, London, the 29th of August. "Dear Mrs. Seaborne, I hope you are well. I should tell you at once that Luke doesn't know I'm writing. He'd be angry if I told him, but I think you should know what he has suffered. I know how he wrote to you. I saw your reply. I would never have thought you capable of such cruelty. But I'm not writing to take you to task, only to tell you what has happened in the days since we went to Bethnal Green. You must know by now we encountered there the man who stabbed Edward Burton, and how Luke intervened to protect me. The worst of it is that he grasped the knife by the blade and so wounded his right hand. Those nearby were very kind. A girl tore the skirt from her dress to make a tourniquet under my instructions, and a door was brought so that we could carry him as if by stretcher out of the alleys to Commercial Street, where we were able to hail a cab. Happily, we were very near the Royal London Hospital in Whitechapel, and a colleague there was able to attend to him at once. The wound was cleaned, since infection was our first concern. This caused him a great deal of pain, but he refused any anaesthetic, saying that he prized his mind above anything else and wouldn't have it meddled with. Perhaps I'd better tell you the nature of the injury. Can you bear it? You are content enough with buried bones, but where do you stand on living ones? The knife entered his palm, near the base of his thumb, and with a movement rather like lifting cooked flesh from the bones of a fish more or less flayed, the palm clean off. The muscles were cut through, but what is worse is that two of the tendons, which control the movement of his index and middle fingers, have been severed. The damage was laid out, plain to see. The wound was so clean a student might have looked at it and then passed his anatomy exam. He asked me to operate. He again refused anaesthetic and spoke of the hypnosis techniques he had been studying and how a doctor in Vienna had 3 wisdom teeth removed under hypnosis without flinching. He told me how he trained himself to enter a hypnotic trance so deep he once fell to the floor without waking. Then he said again that he did not believe pain to be any more intolerable than intense pleasure, a preoccupation of his which I have never understood, and extracted from me a promise that I would not put him under anaesthetic unless he begged. I recall his words precisely. He said, "I trust my mind more than I trust your hands." I couldn't ask a nurse to attend. It would not have been fair. I believe he would have prepared the room in his usual fashion if he could, but he could do nothing but lie on his own operating table and give instruction. We were both to wear white cotton masks. I was to set up a mirror so that he could see the procedure if he roused from his trance. He ought to have had the finest surgeon in Europe attending him, not me. My skills are modest at best. In fact, he has been in the habit of mocking them since we were students together. My hands shook each time I picked up the instruments. They rattled on the tray, and I knew he'd see I was afraid. He asked me to unbind the bandages so that he could examine the wound and issue instructions before entering hypnosis, and though I cannot imagine the suffering he endured as the cloth was drawn back from the flesh, he did nothing more than bite down upon his lip and turn very white. I lifted back the flap of his palm, and he surveyed the broken tendons as if they'd only been those of one of the cadavers we'd once cut and stitched. He told me which stitches I should use to bring the 2 ends of the tendons together and ensure the sheath remained intact. How I must not cause the tension in the skin of his palm to strain once the wound was closed. Then he began to whisper beneath his breath to himself, which brought him comfort. He recited scraps of poetry and the names of chemicals and listed all the bones of the human body. Then at last his eyes rolled towards the door and he smiled as if he had seen an old friend come through, and he fell into a trance. I betrayed him. I gave him my promise and knew that I would break it. I waited a few moments and lightly touched the flesh of his hand, and satisfied that he was more or less insensate, I summoned a nurse and we administered the anaesthetic. I operated for more than 2 hours. I will not bore you with details of the surgery, only say with shame that I gave it my best, and it was not enough. No one ever matched him for the minuteness of his skill and for his courage. If he could only have attended to it himself, I believe in a year's time no one would know how badly he'd been injured. I closed the wound, and he was brought round, and when he felt the soreness of the tube in his throat, he knew at once what I had done, and I think he might have throttled me then, if he could. He remained in hospital for 2 days, refusing all visitors. He insisted on having the dressings removed so that he could examine my work. My stitching was no better than a blind child's, he said, but at least I had kept the site clean and there was no sign of infection. When he was well enough to go home, I went with him to his rooms on Pentonville Road, and it was then that we found your letter on the doormat. Let me tell you, where the knife failed, you have succeeded. He is shattered. You have turned out all his lights. You have broken all his windows. 3 weeks have passed and there has been no good news. The tendons that give movement to his index and middle fingers have shortened significantly, and they are crooked towards the palm, giving the appearance of a hook. Perhaps he might regain a greater scope of movement if he were prepared to do the exercises he ought, but he has lost hope. You cut something out of him. He is absent. He has no resolve. I've seen it before in the eyes of dogs whose masters broke their spirit young. Your second letter was a kind one, certainly, but don't you know him well enough to keep your pity to yourself? I won't write again unless he asks me. He can't write. He can't hold a pen. Yours sincerely, George Spencer.
Part 4. These Last Times of Rebellion. September. Chapter 1. Autumn's kind to old winter. Thick sun aslant on the common forgives a multitude of sins. The dog roses have gone over to crimson hips, and children stain their hands green, breaking walnuts open. Skeins of geese unravel over the estuary, and cobwebs dress the gorse in silk. For all that, things aren't as they ought to be. World's End sinks into the marsh, and there's fungus growing in the empty grate. The quay is quiet. Better to risk a lean winter than set sail on polluted waters. Rumours come from Point Clear and St. Osyth, from Wivenhoe and Brightlingsea. The beast in the black water was seen by a fisherman at Tide's Turn one night, and he went clean out of his wits. A child was found half-drowned with a grey-black mark on her belly. A dog's been cast up on the saltings with its head all awry. Now and then a half-hearted watchman sets a fire by a leviathan and makes a mark in the logbook, but never lasts the night. No sign yet of Naomi Banks. It's never said that she must have gone down one night to the marsh and there encountered the serpent, but it's generally assumed.
Banks lets his fishing nets tangle and his red sails moulder and is banned from the white hair for putting the wind up his fellow drinkers.
"Come in, ready or not!"
he bellows from the doorstep and keels into the street. Up in his rooms on the Pentonville Road, Luke's hand knits together well enough. Spencer winds and unwinds the dressing and admires his own needlework and sees the crooking inward of the fingers. Meanwhile, Luke looks placidly out over the wet street and says nothing. He has memorized Cora's first letter, from its first word to her signature.
How could you?
How could you? Her second goes unanswered for all her contrition. Martha writes to Spencer. Edward Burton and his mother are to lose their home, she says. The rent has become intolerable. Not all the laundry and bright rag rugs in London will keep the wolf from the door. Has anything been done? Has Charles anything to report? When can she bring good news? Spencer detects an urgency there between the lines and puts it down to her tender heart, her good, hard conscience. But he has nothing to report and cannot think how to reply. In the high, white Ambrose house, the children have grown very nearly as plump as Charles. Joanna knows the periodic table and the remarkable thing about the hypotenuse and can spot a post-hoc logical fallacy at 100 yards. If on a Monday she resolves to enter Parliament, by Wednesday nothing but the law will do. Charles keeps from her the unlikelihood of either. She'll grow out of hope, as everyone eventually does. Now and then she remembers casting her childish spells with Naomi Banks, and guilt sends her reeling. Where is her red-haired companion now? Do her curls wave in the estuary tides, full 5 fathoms down? She still has a drawing Naomi made of their 2 hands clasped, and she asks Catherine if she can put it in a frame. Catherine wakes one night, hears weeping, and finds the brothers in their sister's arms. They want their mother. They miss the village. It's agreed they'll go down to Essex by the end of the week. "Besides," says Joanna, "there's Magog to think of, still tethered in the garden, missing her master." They're consoled with a trip to Harrods and sufficient cake to sink a sailor. Cora remains in her London hotel, despising the carpets, the curtains. She has in her pocket a letter from Spencer advising her not to visit, and it's so polite the paper is cold in her hands. Martha sees her walk from room to room and can find nothing to say that won't receive a harsh reply. Cora has little interest in her books and bones. She's bored and bad-tempered, and there's a new crease between her eyebrows. Spencer's rebuke has lodged in her, and she's sulking. Her idea of herself has never included selfishness or cruelty. She's always been done to and never doing. It's quite an adjustment. She's gone blundering about, wishing no harm and causing much. Will's letters are prized, read often, unanswered. How can she respond? She buys a postcard from a stand at the station and writes, "I wish you were here." But what good did it ever do to speak one's mind? In his absence, without the possibility of walking with him on the common, of finding on the threshold an envelope, in a neat hand in which she always thinks she can spot the schoolboy, the world grows dull and blunted. There's no longer anything in it to delight or surprise. Then, she's struck by her own folly. To feel so dreary because she can't talk to some Essex parson with whom she has nothing in common. It's absurd. Her pride revolts against it. In the end, it comes more or less down to this. She does not write, because she wants to. She tries, as she has so often tried before, to turn all her unused affection on Francis. How can it be that a mother and son should take so little pleasure from each other? She pulls every trick in the book, conversations on subjects that please him, attempts at jokes and games. She tries her hand at baking and buys him novels she's certain he'll like. Sometimes she catches him out, looking anxious, or thinks she does, and tries to console. They make frequent journeys on the underground to destinations of his choosing. He submits with few words and less affection. And sometimes she thinks he is sorry for her, or, much worse, finds her amusing. Martha loses her temper.
Did you really think you could carry on like that? You never wanted friends or lovers. You wanted courtiers.
What you have on your hands is a peasant's revolt. Frankie, she says, we're going for a walk.
Will stands in the All Saints pulpit and looks out at his flock and finds himself lost for words. They are by turns mistrustful and eager. At times, it seems, they're ready to run pell-mell into the everlasting arms. At others, they eye him askance as if the trouble has all been his doing. Someone, somewhere, has transgressed. That is the general consensus. And if the parson can't be trusted to root out the wrongdoer, things have come to a pretty pass. All the while he finds himself wavering like a compass needle between the South Pole and the North. His wife, whom he loves, and is the sanctioned source of all his joys, and Cora Seaborn, who is not, and what's more, brought him nothing but trouble. News of Luke's catastrophe has reached him via Charles. Other clergy might have imagined this swift end to the surgeon's career to have been as divinely intended as if it had been the almighty hand wielding the knife, since it delivers Stella from the threat of the scalpel. Will, of course, is not so backward in his thinking. But all the same, it's difficult not to feel they've been extended a period of grace. The brutal treatment once offered by Garrett, the diseased lung collapsed in its cavity, is now impossible, since no other surgeon in England would consent to it. Without Cora, he finds his thoughts lack direction. What, after all, is the point of observing this, of encountering that, if he cannot tell her and watch her laugh or frown in response? He finds himself restless, uneasy. Often he grows exasperated with them both for having permitted only a lapse in good manners, this is how he frames it to himself, to cut the knot between them. Perhaps she finds herself too enraptured by her wounded friend to recall the country parson with his ailing wife, brings him rich food he ought not to eat, learns to dress the cut, to tug silk stitches from the skin. He clothes her in white and seats her at the doctor's feet, her head bent over his ruined hand, and is appalled to find himself envious. All the same, he thinks, soon enough a letter will pass either this way or that between town and country. It only remains to be seen who'll be first to unfold a sheet of paper, to lick the nib of their pen. Behind Stella Ransom's ribs, tubercles are forming. If Cora could have seen them, they'd have put her in mind of the toadstones she collects on her mantelpiece. They send out scavenger cells, infections setting in. The blood vessels of her lungs are beginning to disintegrate and show themselves in scarlet flecks on her blue handkerchiefs. Of them all, only Stella is happy. It is the space Tisica, which confers on the tubercular patient a light heart, a hopeful spirit. She brims with joy unspeakable and full of glory
beatified by suffering, devoutly occupied in her taxonomy of blue. Like a magpie decking its nest, she gathers talismans around her of gentian seed packets and sea glass and spools of navy thread, and all throughout her eyes are fixed on heaven. She feels her feet have left the mud they once were mired in. She wakes in the night, sweat-drenched, in a light euphoric fever, and has seen the face of blue-eyed Christ. Sometimes she hears the whisper of the serpent summoning, and is not afraid. There was once another like it. She knows that enemy of old. Her love for her husband and her children does not diminish, but grows distant. It is as if a fine blue veil has been drawn between them. Will is attentive in his loving. He hardly leaves her side. He sees the skin of her hands is dry and brings back from Colchester a bottle of Yardley's lotion. Sometimes she draws his head down to her shoulder and cradles it as though the disease were his. No more a fool now than she ever was. She's seen his attachment to Cora grow knotted and pities him. "My beloved's hers, and she is his," she writes in her blue book without rancor. "When is Cora coming back?" she says that night, playing cat's cradle with blue ribbon. "When does she leave London? I've missed hearing you talk together." "At night on my bed I sought him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, and I found him not. Once we shared a pillow, and he said, 'Stella, my star, my breath is yours, and yours is mine. Now it is 15 steps from my door to his, so he's safe from the contagion that's in me.' Oh, but he has a better helpmeet. Let him kiss her with the kisses of his mouth, for his love is better than wine, and she has the stomach for it." "I understand. There's a kind of blue paint they call ultramarine, because the stones they grind to make it are borne to us over the sea." Chapter 2. A woman walked on stage alone at the Mile End Assembly Hall. Slight, dark-browed, darkly dressed, she surveyed her scant audience good-humouredly. Perhaps 100 men and women waited whispering under the white vault. Here, then, was Eleanor Marks Aveling, and more than her father's daughter. Among them, breathless from his walk, sat Edward Burton, feeling dwindled down to nothing inside his winter coat. Martha fidgeted beside him.
"I met her once, you know," she said, glinting. "She said to call her Tussie, like her friends."
Left to his own devices, Burton may not have chosen to attend a public meeting of the Socialist League, but Martha had been impossible to resist.
"No sense just listening to me," she'd said, pouring tea from the cooling pot. "No sense taking things second-hand. I'll go with you. We'll walk together. You can't be forever cooped up here with your plans."
In the weeks of his convalescence, the earth had leaned a little further from the sun. The air now was bright, gleaming, as though he viewed the world through a polished pane of glass. It had struck him lately that if his body these days was weary, his mind, at last, was not. Samuel Hall had roused him from a long slumber. It seemed impossible that there'd been years when he'd taken his allotted place without complaint, fitting neatly into the whole grinding enterprise of London. What he saw about him now was a sick body convulsing as it shook off its fever, disease coursing in the arteries of its roads and canals, poison silting in the chambers of its halls and factories. He was awake, painfully, restlessly so. He ate his bread wondering what long hours the dying men worked in the flour mills. He watched his mother stitching scraps and knew her worth to be less than that of the bricks in the street. The landlord raised their rent, and he saw it not as an act of personal greed, simply another symptom of the sickness. He thought of Samuel Hall's cracked skull, and his own guilt was overlaid with pity. Hall had been degraded by enslavement, as they all were. This new fervour was indistinguishable from what he felt for Martha, and he made no attempt to set one aside from the other. He'd never been much in the company of women. They'd been prized objects to be bickered over, and rarely more than that. Now he sought no other company but hers, and could scarcely name the boys and men who'd once clustered round his Holborn desk. She seemed to him neither man nor woman, but some other sex entirely. How she stood in the window with a hand pressed to the scooped hollow of her back, how once between her shoulder blades he'd seen sweat blot her dress. These gave him a thirst. He was afraid he could never drink deep enough to sate. But she was also brisk, combative, indifferent to praise, would not give ground, moved him to laughter, never tried to please, played no tricks. Edward knew himself outwitted and outgunned. That she spoke so often of Cora Seaborne in a manner by turns fond and furious seemed wholly in keeping. She was a being like none he'd ever known, and he accepted her completely. His mother was wary.
"I've never known it," she'd said, put out that Martha always left their rooms a fraction neater than she found them. "A woman needs her own home, and a man in it. A waste, I call it. And should she be here on her own?"
No theatrics from the stage in the assembly hall, still less the ardour of a Bible rally preacher. The speaker's tone was matter of fact, perhaps a little wearied.
"She has suffered," thought Burton, certain of it.
"It's a sad and hideous story," said Eleanor Marks, and it seemed to those watching that she grew in stature as she spoke, her masses of hair unwinding. "This unholy alliance of masters, lawyers, and magistrates against the wage slaves."
Beside him, Martha nodded once, twice, made marks in her notebook. In the front row, a woman holding a sleeping infant sat quite still, but weeping. Now and then a dissenting voice broke through and was silenced by a look. The stage seemed thronged with girls, broken by machinery, and boys flayed by the blast furnace, while standing by, stout men fondled their watch chains and watched their capital accumulate.
"These are hard times, and even harder times will come until this bad order is replaced. This is not the end of our struggle. It is the beginning."
There were cheers and a hat thrown on stage. No bow, but a raised hand, which was a gesture both of farewell and encouragement. "Yes," thought Edward Burton, standing and putting a hand to his aching breast.
"Yes, I see. But how?"
On a bench in a small square park, he ate chips with vinegar. Children dressed in party clothes stood waiting on the curb, and behind them, standard sellers bawled the evening news.
"But how?" he said. "It makes me stupid sometimes, all I read and hear. I have anger in me, and I don't know what to do with it."
"It is how they'd have us," said Martha.
It's not the function of the wage slave to think. The girls at Bryant and May, the boys down in the quarries, do you think they've time to think, to plot, to revolutionise? That's the great crime, that no one need be put in chains when their own minds are shackles enough. Once I thought we were no better than the horses tied to the plough. But it's so much worse. We're only moving parts in their machinery, just the bolts on the wheel, the axle turning round and round.
What then? I must work. I cannot escape the machine.
Not yet, she said. Not yet. But change is slow. Even the world turns by inches. Weary, Edward leaned against the bench. Croesus touched the chestnut trees, the oaks and London limes. His friend was by his side.
Martha, he said.
Just that. And it was enough for now. You're pale, she said. Ned, let me take you home. She kissed him, and on her mouth there was a grain of salt. Edward Burton, 4 Templar Street.
Martha, won't you marry me?
Don't we do all right together, you and I? Edward. By hand. Dear Ned, I cannot marry you. I cannot marry at all. I cannot promise to love, honour, and obey. I obey only as my reason commands me to obey. I honour only those whose actions demand that I must honour them. And I cannot love you as a wife's obliged to love a husband. I see the day coming when Cora Seaborn's done with me, but I can never be done with her. What now? Do you think politics stops at the doorstep? Do you think it only a matter of soapboxes and picket lines, and not also a matter of our private lives? Don't ask me to enter an institution that puts me in bonds and leaves you free. There are other ways to live. There are bonds beside those sanctioned by the state. Let's live as we think, freely and unafraid. Let's be bound by nothing but affection and by holding our purpose in common. If you cannot have a wife, will you take a companion? Will you have a comrade? Your friend, Martha.
Edward Burton, 4 Templar Street. Dear Martha, I will. Edward. Chapter 3.
Little Harriet, yellow-dressed, youngest of the laughing girls, woke before dawn and vomited into her pillow. In the corner her mother stirred, and rising to comfort her child, breathed in the morning air, choked, and vomited also. Coming from the black water on a warm west wind, a vile smell had entered the room through a broken window pane. Creeping past World's End and finding nothing there, it had passed over and come to the borders of Oldwinter, where few lights shone. Leaving the child in her mother's arms, it came to the Banks cottage, and borne on the breeze, stirred the red sails of the barges in the quay. Weighted by drink, Banks slept too deeply to be roused, but something troubled him in the dark, and 3 times he said his lost daughter's name. On it went, past the white hare, and on the doorstep a stray dog whined for a master long gone. Past the school, where Mr. Caffin, already up, marking grammar notebooks, deploring abuse of the comma, gave a cry of disgust and ran to fetch a glass of water. Rooks had begun to gather in Traitor's Oak on the common, sensing in the reeking air a feast. At Cora's grey house, it crept above the door, beneath the lintel. It seeped into the fabric of the sheets on her bed, and could not find her. It skirted the All Saints Tower and reached the window of the rectory. William Ransom, sleepless in his study, thought perhaps a mouse lay rotting beneath the boards. Pressing his shirt's cuff to his mouth, he went on his knees below the desk, beside the empty chair he kept beside his own, and found nothing. Stella, in a blue satin garment, through which the bones of her shoulder blades flared like little wings, appeared at the threshold.
"What on earth?"
she said, caught between laughing and choking.
"What on earth?"
She held a bunch of lavender to her nose.
"A dead thing somewhere," said Will, putting his own jacket around her, afraid she'd begin one of the coughing fits which shook her small body as if it were held in the jaws of a predator.
"Something on the common. A sheep?"
"Not Magog, I hope," said Stella. "We'd never be forgiven."
But no. The last of Cracknell's family could be seen at the garden's end, untroubled, chewing an early breakfast.
"Will, should we light a fire? Oh, it's foul! Foul! You'll go out on the common and see the earth split open and sinners looking up with all their bones broken and their lips cracked with thirst."
Her eyes glittered as if the prospect pleased her, and it troubled Will more than the vile air, which he almost thought he could taste there on the tip of his tongue. Something fetid, with a horrid sweetness behind it. Ought he to go out there? Perhaps he should. Certainly he must. Who else was there to seek out the cause of all that had lately befallen the village? He lit a fire, and shortly the reek was displaced by wood smoke. Stella tossed in her lavender, and there was a brief and piercing scent of recent summer.
"Go on," she said, straightening the papers on his desk. "So many letters. Did he never put them away?"
Giving him his coat.
10 minutes more, and we'll hear the bell, and you'll be wanted somewhere by someone."
Kissing her, he said, "Perhaps a fishing boat has gone aground on the Saltins and spilt its cargo, and the fish is rotting. Already it's a warm enough morning."
"I wish the babies were here," she said. "Wouldn't Jojo have woken before us all and gone down with a lamp and seen for herself, and James done a drawing for the papers?"
Out on the high road a crowd had gathered. Mr. Caffin had wound a white cloth about his head as if he'd been wounded. Others pressed a sleeve to their mouths and peered suspiciously at Will, casting about for signs of a Bible or some other weapon concealed in the crook of his arm. It did not occur to Will until that moment, until he scented on the dim air not only rottenness, but fear. That perhaps there was another cause to the foul odour besides misfortune. But there was Harriet's mother, weeping, as she so often was, crossing herself. There was Banks, not yet sober, saying he'd not go down to the water in case the beast had belched up coils of red hair. Evansford, in his black shirt, looking more than ever like an undertaker bereft of a corpse, stood reciting fragments of the Book of Revelation with evident glee. Even Mr. Caffin, who each year taught his students that the 31st of October was nothing but the anniversary of Martin Luther taking hammer and pins to his 95 theses, looked, thought Will, rather green about the gills.
"Good morning, and a fine one at that," he said. "And what's this that's brought us all out of our beds?"
No answer came.
"Now, as you all know, I'm no seafaring man," he said, heartily thumping Banks on the shoulder. "And you can't expect me to know anything about anything. Mr. Banks, you know the Blackwater better than us all. What's the cause of this dreadful business, do you think?"
The wind rose. The smell strengthened. Will gagged and said,
"Some algae, perhaps, drifted in from overseas? A shoal of herring beached on the shingle?"
"Not anything I've ever smelt before or heard